Our first speaker today is Mr. Jeremy Travis. He has both a JD and a master's in public administration. He's been president of John Jay College at the City University of New York since 2004. Prior to this, he served 4 years as a senior fellow with the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute. And while there, he launched a national research program on prisoner reentry. From 1994 to 2000, he directed the National Institute of Justice. He also served as Deputy Commissioner for Legal Matters for the New York City Police Department and was Chief Counsel to the U.S. House Judiciary Subcommittee on Criminal Justice. He's written 3 books. I read his latest one on prisoner reentry, but they all come back from cover to cover. I can highly recommend it to you. He's testified before Congress, and he served a 5-year term on the United Nations Interregional Crime and Justice Research Institute. He's received many prestigious awards from organizations such as the American Society of Criminology, the Academy of Criminal Justice Sciences, the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, and the International Corrections and Prisons Association. Mr. Travis is married. He has 2 daughters and a dog. He runs. He loves to play tennis. And he has a standing commitment every Tuesday and Wednesday night. You'll find him at home watching none other than American Idol. So Mr. Travis is able to accept only a couple of these presentations a year, given his busy schedule. So the Family Impact Seminars are very pleased to present him to you today. Please give a warm welcome to Jeremy Travis. His talk today is Rethinking Prisoner Reentry, the Policy Implications of High Rates of Incarceration. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much for the warm welcome. Wasn't quite sure what to expect after that football game a few days ago, so it was nice to be welcomed as a New Yorker here in Wisconsin. And it's really terrific to be invited to be part of this Family Impact Seminar. I'm very intrigued by the model that's been tested here over the past nearly 2 dozen years. And it looks like a very successful way of bringing academics and policymakers and practitioners together to talk about important things. It's also nice, just on a personal note, to be part of the tag team with Ed Latessa, who's a great colleague. And we've done this at other places around the country and in other countries, in fact. So it's nice to be here with him. And a special thanks to Karen Morgenschneider and Heidi Normandine, who have put together this conference. So here's what I want to do in my 30 minutes. I'm going to paint a very big picture, a national picture, in fact, of the phenomenon of prisoner reentry, and want to use this as an occasion to sort of stimulate some thinking within the group that's assembled here about sort of the extent of what is happening now in our country. This is not a Wisconsin-specific talk. I'll let you and some of the material you had fill in the blanks in terms of what is the Wisconsin application of what I'm talking about. So I'm really coming at this as a phenomenon of national importance and one that is resonating in every state across the country. So Wisconsin is certainly not alone, and it has profound implications for a number of attributes of our democracy that we care about a lot. Families is one I'll talk about today in particular, but has implications for our voting rights, for racial justice, for crime, for the delivery of social services. That's the point I want to make in my 30 minutes, is we have a very new, unparalleled, unprecedented phenomenon that we're experiencing in the country with ripple effects that we have yet to begin to really take into account. Let me define first the word reentry, because it's important to use words with precision. Here's how I define it. Reentry is the inevitable consequence of a period of confinement. And Heidi referred to this phrase that I've coined, the iron law of imprisonment or the iron law of incarceration, which is that with the exception of those people who die, either because we execute them or because they die of natural causes, when you think about it, everybody we put in prison comes out, right? Everyone we send to prison comes back at some point. It may be a month, maybe a year, maybe 10 years, maybe 20 years. But unless they die in prison, they come back. So the reentry phenomenon is that experience of leaving a period of confinement. And it could be a prison, it could be a jail, it could be adult, it could be juvenile, it could be federal, it could be state. It doesn't really much matter from a personal point of view of the person who is experiencing incarceration, the deprivation of liberty, and the experience of leaving that and going home. That's the reentry experience. That's what we want to sort of think about, focus on, not only as an individual matter. We also want to look at the policy consequences, but we particularly want to think about this as the aggregation of lots of individual experiences, starting with the person who's been incarcerated, but extending to networks of family and peer groups and ultimately neighborhoods and communities. So that's the word that is the important sort of linchpin here, is to think about reentry. Now, we've got to get the technology working here. Okay. So here are the, I pointed at that, and press that button, and it works. It's so exciting when it happens. So here are the, just to, I'm not suggesting you sort of fade out for the next 20 minutes, but here are the points I want to make, and this is sort of a roadmap of the talk. The first one, important one, is that lots more people are leaving prison than ever before in our country. We want to talk about why that's happening and some sense of the magnitude. Importantly, and in ways that we have not sort of stayed in touch with, those people leaving, lots more of them, are leaving less prepared for that journey home than they used to be at an earlier point in time. On the outside, we have a diminished capacity in terms of social programs, in terms of social support, for to support those people leaving home, to help them make that journey successfully. Fourth, they face significant challenges that we'll talk about in terms of health and employment and the like. And this whole process of many more people less prepared coming out with less support on the outside has enormous consequences for families and communities. So that's the roadmap of the journey. Here we go. Here's the first important point to take away. Many more people leaving prison. Now, we talk about reentry sometimes as if it were a sort of this tidal wave. All of a sudden, lots of people getting out of prison, and we hadn't been sort of preparing ourselves for it. Just the opposite. What's happened is over the past, and these are this up to 2000, if you updated this with more recent data, you'd see those trends continuing. Over the past here 30 years, we've seen more people going into prison, and therefore, iron law of incarceration, more people coming out. And it's been a very steady increase in the number of people coming out. So the blue line, the bottom one, is the people being released from prison. The top line, the red one, is people being put into prison. This is a picture not of who's in prison. That's the way we often think about prison. How many people do we have in prison? This is a picture of the flow, people going in and leaving. And we've increased incarceration in this country fourfold over the past generation. In our generation, looking in the room, most of us about same age, give or take 10 years, in our generation, our country has increased the per capita rate of imprisonment more than fourfold. So incarceration has gone up in good times and bad times. Incarceration has gone up when we've had times of war, times of peace, when the economy's been strong, when it's been weak, when it's been Republicans, when it's been Democrats in control of various state legislatures. Incarceration has gone up in this country. We are on an imprisonment binge. So a consequence of that, we can talk about some why that's happened, but a consequence, that's what we're talking about today, the consequence of that is many more people have been cycled in and out of prison. And that's the reentry phenomenon that we're now talking about and coming to grips with. Now, the iron law of incarceration is sort of illustrated in this slide. More people in, more people out. And there's also, you can see a little lag between the two lines. That is, we're putting people in for slightly longer prison terms than used to be the case, so they're coming out at slightly lower rates. But this is not a new phenomenon. It's a new policy discussion that's been launched in the last 10 years. So more people coming out of prison, and it's now about, if you would look at the most recent Bureau of Justice Statistics data, it's now getting close to 700,000 a year. So that's about 1,900 people a day making this journey home. And 20 years ago, it was a quarter of that. So we're in a very different state of affairs, and we'll see where the effects are felt most acutely because it's not evenly distributed. Now, we know that the costs of this phenomenon are high. Let's talk about public safety. First and foremost, we have to think about the public safety costs of people coming in and out of prison. The rates of failure in terms of rearrest rates of people coming out of prison are very high. The Bureau of Justice Statistics, part of the U.S. Department of Justice, publishes every once in a while studies, and state organizations do this as well, looking at the recidivism rate. That can be defined in different ways. For these purposes, we're defining recidivism as being rearrested for one or more serious crimes within 3 years. So that's your definition. It's a rearrest definition of recidivism. The Bureau of Justice Statistics report tells you that two-thirds of the people being released from our state prisons are rearrested for one or more serious crimes within 3 years. So if you want to call that failure, which is, I think, a pretty apt description, that's a high rate of failure for this system of incarceration and reentry. Not everybody's reconvicted, not everybody's sent to prison, but I like to start with that two-thirds number because that's, I think, from a public safety, community safety point of view, the relevant number. The fiscal implications of this system are high. Heidi mentioned that at the outset in terms of your budget. Every state is going through some version of what you're going through. Prison costs are eating up larger and larger chunks, shares of the discretionary funding at the state level. And now that I run a college funded by the state, I'm very concerned about this because it's basically squeezing out higher education costs, but it's competing with Medicaid and Medicare and other types of costs. So very high social costs, fiscal costs, and we'll talk more about the social costs throughout the talk. So let's talk about this issue of preparation. One would think that it would be standard fare for everybody who's in prison to be prepared for this inevitable journey home. This would be a way that corrections thinks about its job. And that, according to BJS statistics, is not the case. Only 10% or so of people coming out of state prisons, this is not a Wisconsin statement, I don't know Wisconsin data, participate in some sort of discharge planning program. You'll see here, again, BJS data, that there's been a decline in the percent who participate in educational programs and vocational programs, the types of programs you think would be, again, standard fare for people coming out of prison. Why is that decline happening? My guess, reasonable hypothesis, is because these programs cost money. If you have a budget that's very tight and your first priority is safety and security of people who are incarcerated and the people who work there, programming gets squeezed out. So we're not only putting more people in prison, and therefore they're coming out, but we're spending less attention, less time, less money on preparing them for that journey home, and we pay a price for that. Now, people coming out of prison face a number of challenges in terms of that journey home. I think we have to just start by recognizing that the change in life circumstances for somebody who's been incarcerated and somebody who's then returning home are just enormously so profound. And the imagination, I think, is not sufficient here for people to sort of try to think through what it means to have been in prison and leave and go home. So, but you're in an environment where everything's controlled, where your life is ordered on a daily basis. It's a same-sex environment. You're not in a normal circumstance in terms of family relationships or intimate partner relationships. You're with people who, by definition, have been on the wrong side of the law. That's your social network. Trying to find yourself, trying to figure out what you're doing. And you know that at some point you're going home. You know that at some point you're making this journey. So when people come out, the question is, how do they fare? What's their sort of life journey having made that transition from this highly artificial environment to back to the street, back to community life? And we tend to think of this in terms of sort of individual characteristics and sort of issues that people face. And Ed Latessa is one of the national experts on this, and I'll let him give you more of the science here. But these are four dimensions along which we can think about the difficulties that people face when they make this journey. One is substance abuse. The high rates of prior addiction for people who have been in prison. Prisons are by no means drug-free, but they're not the same environment that you face on the street where you can basically find what you need for the right price. So people who have been addicted are basically detoxed and sort of forcibly kept sober while in prison. They're leaving prison and coming home to a different environment where temptation is on the street. Health conditions I want to talk a little bit about because this is not getting enough attention in my view. Employment is an issue. People tend to forget that a lot of people are employed at the time they're arrested. Half of people who go to prison had a full-time job when they were arrested. 20% of them had part-time jobs when they were arrested, so they were engaged not at a high level compared to others, but at some level in the labor market. And they've been taken out of that labor market, and it's hard to sort of explain this on your resume. What have you been doing for the past 2 years? Well, they have to explain it. Then you come back to try to get into the labor market again. So employment is a big challenge. We want to talk about it a little bit. And housing, obvious first question is, where are you going to sleep your first night out? How are you going to reconnect to family? Do you have a place to stay? Housing is a big challenge. But for all of these challenges that we'll go into a little bit deeper in the next few minutes, they have the same characteristics. There's a high prevalence of the problem, drug addiction, unemployment, and the like. There's some but not much work done while people are in prison, getting people ready for that journey so that they can reconnect along these dimensions. There's evidence, scientific evidence, of program effectiveness that Dr. Letessa will help shed some light on, where you can intervene in prison and have a continuum of intervention back in the community. You can actually make a difference in recidivism rates. And what we know is that there are very few linkages between what happens in prison and what happens in the community. So let's go a little bit deeper into some of these. Three-quarters, again, national data, and I would be surprised if it was any different here in Wisconsin, three-quarters of people in prison have a history of alcohol and or substance, illegal substance abuse. So you have a population that by definition has a serious health issue, that is their addiction, and by definition are dealing with the absence of these substances in their lives, and by definition will face high rates of relapse when they come back home. So one of the most important things a state can do is to fund the type of drug treatment that starts in prison and continues when people go back home. Because what do we care about? We care about relapse. We care about people going back to drug use. When is the risk highest? Right after they come out. Only 18% of those participate in formal treatment programs. A good piece of data to collect here in Wisconsin would be to see how you measure up against that national statistic. And as I said, there are studies that show high rates of effectiveness, very high rates of effectiveness at reducing return to drug use and recidivism. Let's talk about diseases. Prisoners are, compared to other Americans, a very unhealthy group of people. They have serious health issues attributed to, surmise here, issues of lifestyle and ways in which they've been engaged in risky behaviors. But here are just some data that that illustrate the point of the prevalence of, and I'm focusing here on communicable diseases among the prison population. May sound like a low percent to have HIV/AIDS, but that's 5 to 7 times greater than the U.S. population. So if you go to a prison, you are finding a population that has very high rates of HIV/AIDS compared to the U.S. population. Hepatitis C, the same, 18%. But that's 9 to 10 times greater than the U.S. population. The same thing for mental illness, same thing for sexually transmitted diseases. Any health condition that you care about as a public health specialist, you'll find high rates of presentation of that condition in the prison population. So the public health question, I love talking to the public health folks about this, because they look at this as a public health opportunity. And ask their corrections colleagues, what are you doing to intervene in the lives of the people who are in your care and custody and are going nowhere to make sure that when they come out, they pose a lower risk of communicable diseases and spreading communicable diseases to others than they did going in? And we tend to think of prison health care as sort of what's the minimum to keep people sort of meeting their constitutional standards. But here's an opportunity to intervene in prison in a very different way. Let's talk next about employment. I gave you the statistics in terms of employment rates. Half of people have full-time jobs when they're arrested, 20% part-time jobs. So the question here is, how do we reconnect people to the world of work when they come out? We know that work is an important stabilizing factor in people's lives. There's one of my favorite sayings in this world from a parole officer is, the best parole officer in the world is a boss. Right, sort of make sure you stay on track, get to work at 9 o'clock. You're productive. So we believe, as Americans, we believe that work is a centering experience for people. But we make it difficult and place lots of barriers in the way to people coming out of prison to reconnect to the world of work. So there's a lot of research here that talks about how to find the transitional employment to help people get back on their feet. There's definitely a need for that transitional employment. In New York City, we're about to launch a supported work program to actually, where the city is actually going to pay for people to work because the rates of unemployment are so high and the rates of the level of marginalization is so high. So here's one little statistic to sort of illustrate the point of the intersecting forces of race and prior record. A white felon, so a white individual with a criminal record, is more likely to get a job than an African-American male with no criminal record. Think about this. And this is demonstrated by some pioneer work by Diva Pager, sending out testers, auditors who have, you know, basically similar resumes and similar stories. One has a record, one doesn't. So a white with a criminal record, a felony conviction, has a greater chance of being called back for a job than an African-American male without one. And if you add the criminal conviction to the employment record of the African-American male, his chances decrease by another 40%. So there are enormous barriers. It's placed in the way of people trying to get work. And we care about work. We care as Americans about work, but we also sometimes require work as a condition of parole. So there's a real sort of catch-22 here. So we have to think very creatively, in my view, about how to reconnect people to the world of work. Let's talk about housing for a second. Housing, a roof over the head, is an obvious imperative when people come out of prison. The research that we were doing at the Urban Institute was really eye-opening because it showed the people coming out of prison. So they go to the family for a while. Family doesn't always want them. They sort of hang out with friends for a while. It's not that they're homeless necessarily, but they're not stable. They're not stabilized in terms of housing condition. Their wife or intimate partner might welcome them back. Then tension erupts. So there's a lot of instability in the basic housing picture of people coming out of prison. And some of the most innovative programs that I've seen around the country are those that try to think about setting aside some transitional housing that a lot of communities have for people who are sort of down and out in their luck, the mentally ill, or those who are coming off of welfare or whatever, set aside some for people coming out of prison. So housing is a very important challenge. Like work, it's a centering part of life. We also talk about the relationship between prisons and homelessness. So there's almost a sort of two revolving doors. There's a revolving door in and out of homeless shelters, another revolving door in and out of prison. For people who are really marginalized, don't have housing to fall back on, high rates of sort of overlap between those two populations. So people who care about homelessness should care about reentry. Let's talk about families, and here we are, after all, at the Family Impact Seminar. When legislatures around the country pass the laws that have resulted in a fourfold increase in the per capita rate of incarceration, we did not intend to punish families. We did not intend that the children of people who have done wrong, whatever they've done, would bear the brunt of our decision to punish them in a certain way. And one of the most profound effects that we are having because of our policies of incarceration is not only on the individuals who are now, many more of them, in and out of prison, but these ripple effects through the next generation and through the family structures that are so important. So Heidi said, I don't do as much public speaking as I used to. That's true. But one reason I came here is because I wanted to talk about this point, and I know this is the focus of your work. Everybody who goes to prison has some sort of family network that they leave behind. That family network has to adjust in ways to accommodate this new reality that Johnny or Janie has gone off to prison. These adjustments let's acknowledge it, sometimes they're welcome. Sometimes the family's relieved that so-and-so has gone off. This is the guy who was taking their money for his crack addiction, who was skimming off the family budget, who was doing whatever he was doing. It may be a relief to the family, maybe a good thing. But the majority of families have a different circumstance, where the person in their lives was providing some mix of positive and negative influences. And the family has to adjust. And the family has to adjust in particular if there are children involved, children left behind when this individual goes to prison. Mother goes to prison makes it particularly difficult. Women are the dominant child rearers in our society. So we often find the situation of grandparents taking care of their grandchildren when mom goes off to prison. Dads in this world are not particularly reliable. We have lots of data in terms of dads not being present. So a dad going off to prison has a different set of ripple effects. But the ripple effects are there, and we don't take account of them. Starting at the moment of arrest, when the police arrest, I used to be general counsel in the New York City Police Department, you think about how do we handle the presence of a minor when mom or dad is arrested? How do we think about who's caring for that kid that night? What do we think about foster care? How do we think about making sure that kid has some sort of ability to cope and respond to the trauma involved with that incident? So we don't think about families much when we think about punishing people for their crimes. And we certainly don't think about it when we think about the reentry process. So here's this guy or this woman coming out of prison. The research we did at the Urban Institute shows high levels of optimism when people are getting ready to come out of prison. It's a powerful moment. And they come out and they face a circumstance where the world is unwelcoming. And families are, it depends. Sometimes it's, we're glad you're home. Sometimes there was a yellow ribbon around the proverbial oak tree. Sometimes there's tension. Sometimes there's friction. And those circumstances of that support network can make all the difference. When I was doing work in Baltimore, one of the most interesting sort of stakeholders we had at the table was a local community dispute resolution organization that wanted to be at the table to help work through those family tensions as people were coming out of home. So what we see here is that the spread of incarceration has led to a high rate of impact on children. We have 1.5 million children with minor children with their parents in prison. It totals up to about 1.8% of all minor children in America have somebody in prison as we speak today. If you add probation and parole and jail, it's about 10% of minor children in our country have a parent who's somehow today involved in the criminal justice system. It should not be a surprise to us that we have so ramped up the use of the criminal justice system as our response to crime that we're having these enormous effects on children. And because there's this intersection between race and incarceration that I won't talk about today, there's a high rate of impact upon children of color. So the 7.8% of the minor children in the African-American community today have a parent in prison. And that's not adding prison, probation, parole, and jail. So the final point I want to make here, and then wrap up with a couple of thoughts for you, has to do with the implication of this high rate of incarceration for communities. So the incarceration phenomenon is not spread evenly across our country, right? We understand that. It's concentrated in the communities where people that we send to prison come from. So in every community around the country where I've done work or my colleagues have done work, you will find this phenomenon that I use some data here from Brooklyn to illustrate, which is that the high rates of incarceration and supervision are concentrated in a very small number of neighborhoods, not just cities, not counties, actual neighborhoods in every state in the country. And if you go to the Urban Institute website, we did these concentration analyses in probably 7 or 8 different states, and we always found some version of this, and in Wisconsin it's no different, that you can pinpoint the effects of our policies down to the block level. So when you look at the block level, you find, as we found in Brooklyn, blocks where 1 in 8 parenting age male, that's 18 to 45, is admitted to jail or prison every year. And they're in and they're out and they're in and they're out. So that means that over time you get a very high rate of what I call penetration of justice into these communities, where the justice experience, the arrest and incarceration experience, is a modal experience. Most people, most men in the neighborhoods that we're describing here, have this experience in their lives. So to the extent there are barriers and detriments and negative consequences for that experience, we are concentrating those negative consequences in a very small number of neighborhoods. So this is the profound social cost, the profound intergenerational cost that we're taking on here. And to the extent there are racial dimensions to this, which there invariably are, it is a real impediment to our pursuit of racial justice in the country. And to the extent that we bar these individuals from voting, which most states, including Wisconsin, do, it means that we are having profound effects on our democracy. Now, there are some states, not yours, that where voting is prohibited for life once you have a felony conviction. So in these communities, A quarter of the African-American men cannot vote for life. So just think about it. So we don't think about these long-term consequences. We pass lots of laws, and I've referred to them in my writing and in the material you have as our network of invisible punishment. We, legislatures, pass many laws to, in essence, punish additional people, punish people additionally for their felony convictions. We deny them voting rights. Our Congress has said that people with drug convictions can't get welfare, can't get food stamps. We deny education loans. Congress has done that. Many states require registration. Sex offenders can't live in certain neighborhoods. So we have a network of invisible punishment that lingers on after the prison doors close and after supervision is over. And we don't think about the long-term consequences for social reintegration of the individuals that we sent off to prison. So what do we do? And that's what we're here to talk about. It's easy on some level for me to get up and say, look where we are, where we've come from, and particularly what are legislatures to do. I won't talk today about sort of the laws that put so many people in prison. That's another discussion. Happy to have it, but it deserves more time. But one thing legislatures can do is think about this issue of preparation for people when they're coming out of prison. How well are corrections institutions doing that work? Ed Letessa will certainly talk about that. Talk about the effectiveness of supervision. Our sort of basic response is to place people on supervision when they get out. But in fact, research is showing that supervision is not reducing crime, so we have to rethink the way we supervise people. What does supervision mean? What sort of barriers do we place? What expectations do we have? We have to think about revocation when people get sent back to prison. We have a back door that a lot of people going back to prison because we revoke their parole, often for technical reasons. They failed a drug test or they failed to keep an appointment. I have proposed in some of my writings the idea of reentry courts. Drug courts are a great success, good research on this. Reentry courts are another way to think about using judicial authority to oversee the back end of this process and to make the policies more transparent. And the final thing that I think legislatures can do is take a really searching look at this network of invisible punishment that states have enacted. What are the laws that have been enacted in Wisconsin that have the effect of posing barriers to people's reintegration? How do we tailor them to the circumstances where they're appropriate, to the individual circumstances where they're appropriate? How do we provide some sort of relief for those people for whom they're inappropriate? These are very nuanced policy discussions, but I think we've painted with a very broad brush. And the most important thing that I think a legislature can do is to pay attention to the concentrations at the community level. So I was given some data here from a Milwaukee zip code. You may know this zip code, 53206, which has the largest number of families in poverty in the state. And here's some data that I hope brings this presentation home. Nearly two-thirds of the men in that zip code between the ages of 30 and 34 years old either are now or have been incarcerated. Two-thirds. So imagine growing up male in that community. What's your role model? How do you think about your life circumstances, your life journey? Over half of the men have returned to prison one or more times. And this is not unique. So it's fairly commonplace for legislatures to enact sentencing laws. That's what you do. That's what we expect. But the impact of the sentencing laws is what I think is called for in terms of the next generation of our policy debate. So thanks a lot.
We're going to take a couple questions from Mr. Travis. Now, we're audio taping for legislators who drive long distances to the Capitol, so we're asking that you speak into the mic. The person on the mic is Heidi Normandin, the state coordinator, the reason these seminars run so smoothly. And the purpose of the discussion and questions is to give state policymakers and state agency administrators an opportunity to ask questions of our national experts. So I want to be able to recognize as many state legislators and state agency administrators as possible. So you have some questions for Mr. Travis.
It was too depressing.
Any questions? Yes.
Great. Thanks.
Senator Rensselaer.
Couple things. One thing I think of, you say that supervision's not working. And good morning, and thanks for coming. And that on the outside and at the end of their prison sentence, their release, they have supervision, it's not working. Now, something that does work extremely well is on the front end, and it's with non-property, non-violent, or non-person. They're basically property crimes,
yep.
But it could be expanded. And it would have, I believe, the same kind of utilization and positive outcome,
yeah.
Which is something called volunteers in probation. And it's people volunteering. Again, these are folks that haven't committed, mm-hmm. you know, personal crimes. They're property crimes. And it's also typically first offense. They're relationship driven. And it's a volunteer, not a paid person, who is supervising those folks.
Mm-hmm.
And the recidivism is very, very low.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if we might be able to concentrate that in working with some of the paid supervisors in community corrections, also have volunteers working with those folks, because I believe it's all about relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So,
thank you. Let me first of all expand upon the observation I made, perhaps too superficially, that supervision doesn't work. My colleagues at the Urban Institute, Amy Solomon and others, did a study that compared the BJS statistics for those people released from prison who were placed on supervision and those who were not. And some states release as many as half of their prisoners, just show them the door, they don't supervise them. So you can make these comparisons. And when you compare those two groups, what the study found in a very important research finding is that there's no difference in the recidivism rate between those supervised and those not supervised. In admirable ways, the parole and community corrections community has responded to this finding by saying, okay, we've got to now pay attention to this research finding and try to reinvent what it is that we're doing. And they're now thinking about different ways of organizing the supervision activity, thinking about different ways of particularly how they use the powers to revoke people and send them back to, or revoke the parole and send them back to prison. So there's a lot of ferment within the parole community these days in terms of supervision practices. I'm involved with a project in Chicago where we're trying to sort of localize supervision, make it very community-based. And this is an exciting moment, a difficult moment, but exciting moment for my field. And it reminds me actually of the findings from the 70s about policing that showed that the 911 system basically doesn't reduce crime. You know, and policing responded to that by coming up with community policing, which has been very effective. So your idea about sort of who is supervising is at the core, I think, of this question. So without commenting on this particular program, if we think of supervision, in quotes, as a sort of a state function, and this is what the state does to people, as opposed to thinking about reentry and reintegration as a social process where lots of people get involved and the state plays really a sort of backseat role rather than upfront role, we're on our road to thinking about something that's important, because the social science research says that people who do well here have strong social networks, they have strong family networks, they have ties to employment. So remember the comment I made about a parole officer? The parole officer said that the boss is the best parole officer. The boss in that situation is providing supervision. So if we think about a network of these concentric circles of support, and with the state playing a less direct and more supportive role, a brokering role, I think we're on the way to doing something very important.
Time for one more question? Yes.
Thank you for coming here today and enlightening us. You had mentioned that in certain neighborhoods, in certain areas, there are very high levels of incarceration or offense, and also talking about the social networks, and often what people are doing when they get out of prison is going right back to the same family environment, friend environment, and if what got you into trouble in the first place were the friends and the people you associated with and hung out with, and then you get out and you go right back and go to the same circle of friends and often the same circle of relatives who share similar traits, How do we break that? Because it seems to me that, you know, who you associate with is going to determine a lot of your success or failure in creating more and going back to the same life you had before that led to your incarceration.
You're absolutely right. These social networks are very important. We shouldn't go in the direction of saying people can't go back home, because we don't, because the social networks are important both a positive and a negative way. So the question, the policy question is, and the individual choice question is, how do we promote connection to the positive networks and dissuade somebody from reconnecting with the negative networks? As I said in answer to the previous question, I think we need to think quite differently about activating networks at the community level that will help promote success. And this is what I think is ultimately the job of parole, is to think about those networks. And those include work, connection to social services, connection to family, connection to faith institution, if that's appropriate for the individual. But the peer networks turn out to be very important. And there's a natural sort of temptation to go back to what's familiar, and so we have to counteract some of those reattachments to negative forces. And here there's a role, in my view, that's underutilized for people who've formerly been incarcerated. I mean, there are a lot of folks in these neighborhoods who have gone straight and can be a very powerful, positive social network for people coming out. They've traveled the journey. They know the risks. They can talk about that reality. We tend to forget when we make our crime policy that people age out of crime, and we're basically sort of focusing on what is basically a young man's activity. And the folks who have aged out of crime and have developed that sort of personal persistence are very positive peer network that we don't make enough use of. So this is a conversation that you have to have with the individual coming back, and you have to have it with parole in terms of reimagining its role. But you basically have to galvanize community networks in a way that we haven't done in the past. This is a state function of incarceration, sentencing, incarceration, and reentry that has its greatest effects at a community level. And we don't think about what are the community processes that could be our allies in promoting success.